or at FoleyTheater.org. Support for KKFI from the Foley Theater.
Hello, all. I want to update you on the Amp Up for the Future campaign. We have topped $113,000 so far in this investment in KKFI's future. That means we still have $81,000 in matching commitments from a group of wonderful KKFI supporters. Whether it's a one-time gift or a commitment over a couple years, please consider an extra gift above your normal generosity. Or, of course, make your first gift right now, and it will be matched dollar for dollar. To double your gift to KKFI right now, go to kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Again, that's kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. On today's show, host David Bell talks with trauma survivor and victims' rights advocate Kim Case. When she was in her early 20s, the trajectory of Kim's life abruptly changed when she was abducted and brutally assaulted by four men. Realizing the gift of survival, Kim dedicated her life to advocating for and supporting other survivors. You can stay tuned in to hear her story of tragedy, healing, and advocacy. Bad things happen to good people, however, it's important to gather strength from adversity, even as we do from good fortune. The universe has no inherent strategy or design. What we can control is what we can do with the hand we're dealt. Life is not always fair, but each of us can always be fair. We'll play our calendar at the middle of our hour. We hope our listeners are enjoying a wonderful holiday season. Get ready for the days to grow longer. On Jaws of Justice, we investigate how to achieve justice in America. Now, our show.
On June 5th, 1990, a 19-year-old woman was working as a waitress in Gladstone, Missouri. She left work around 10 or 10:30 and went to a local restaurant to meet her friend who was working there. She and her friend left the restaurant around 1:30 and eventually made it to a local breakfast place. After leaving that restaurant, they were standing in the parking lot, and some men that they did not recognize started yelling at them. The 19-year-old woman walked past the men's car, noticing more than one person in the car, and then got into her own truck to leave. She drove to her home in Clay County, Missouri. As she got out of her truck and gathered her work clothes, she heard a car pull up. Thinking it was her girlfriend, she walked toward the car. She realized, however, that the person walking toward her was not her girlfriend, so she asked who it was. At that point, a man grabbed her and put his hands over her mouth. The man pulled her into his car with three other men. The four individuals were eventually caught, charged, and convicted. And here's a list, a representative one, of what one defendant received in three counties for the actions he took that evening. Rape, 15 years. Sodomy, 15 years. Sodomy, 10 years consecutive. Kidnapping, 15 years. Forcible sodomy, 25 years. Forcible sodomy, 25 years. Attempted forcible rape, 25 years. Sexual abuse, 5 years. During our last show, we asked the question, should we be defined solely by the worst thing that we do? In this show, we ask the question, should we be defined solely by the worst thing that has been done to us? To help us answer this question, we speak to the person who endured and survived the crimes listed above, now 30 years later. With that, we welcome Kim Case. Kim, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, David.
Kim, I first want to talk about the terms that you use to describe the various persons involved in the system, and particularly yourself, particularly the individuals that did this. And we have talked about terms of, first starting with you, a victim, and we've talked about a term survivor. And I know those terms have special meaning to you, and if you could help us with your understanding of them.
Yes. You know, after I endured these crimes, it felt like the right thing to say that I was a victim of this crime, because I quickly learned in the criminal justice system that the victim is looked at more as a witness to the crime. And basically then it feels as if this didn't actually happen to me. And so I was more a piece of evidence. And so choosing the word victim allowed me to have some ownership in the tragedy that came upon my life at that time. It was later in life that I felt comfortable using the word survivor, because, you know, it's often come to me that it's been harder to live with this than I think it may have been if I would have died that morning. And so by using the word survivor, it helps me remember the days and the years that have gone by that I've carried, you know, this tragedy with me and have tried to overcome.
When you and I spoke during, as we got to know each other a little bit in preparation for this interview, I got the distinct impression that the word survivor, at least as it means to you, is something, a term that resonates a strength. Strength in the face of just unbelievable adversity. Is am I right in that interpretation of that word?
Yes, definitely. I feel that is a good definition for what it takes to come through something like this. And those that I work with, as they overcome victimization or tragedy or trauma, I like to put the word survivor on them so that they feel empowered and encouraged.
What about terms that we're going to use to describe the four men that became defendants and eventually prisoners? How would you refer to those individuals, as offenders, as defendants? What term would you use?
Yeah, I think the terms that I've used for the offenders have been fluid through the years. I remember during the process of the criminal justice system and trials and guilty pleas and things, they would often be referred to as Mr. and then their name, Mr. And it was difficult for me to digest that by them being called in some term of recognition or endearment. And I remember struggling with that feeling because, you know, they had offended me and had taken so much from me. So I've called them assailants, defendants, offenders through the years, things like that.
As we talk about the court process first, and as part of the healing process, I wanted you to briefly mention your experience when this occurred in 1990 and through the legal process, and the position of a victim advocate. The impression I've gotten from speaking to you is that role was somewhat unheard of, or at least unique in certain jurisdictions, and in fact didn't exist in certain jurisdictions. And if you could walk me through kind of your introduction to that role and how you've seen it develop over time.
Yes. The role of victim advocate or victim liaison, victim witness coordinator has multiple terms, but what I found that role to be was an essential part of the partnership that is needed between the family going through the system as victims and then those in the system that understand the ins and outs and know the big lingo and know the words and the processes. And that role for me became, you know, a very supportive role in helping me feel informed and engaged in the system and that I, you know, was a part of it rather than just being that witness. Because there were three different counties or jurisdictions that this occurred in, it became glaringly obvious that some counties didn't yet have services like that while others did. And one particular county had a position of a victim advocate in place. And I just remember it making me feel so much more supported, kept me very informed on all of the dates that were going on, when I needed to appear, and the different processes. The other counties either had no services or brand new services. And I found myself, you know, just really kind of leaning into that, trying to let them know how important and how cherished their role was for me.
You know, I spoke to a victim advocate in one of the counties that you worked with, and what she told me, and I've asked your permission to bring this out, but what she told me was that she received a lot of instruction from you, meaning it was new to her, and because you had been through it in two other counties, you were actually to help, you helped her define what her role would be in helping not only you, but victims that would come before her in the future.
It means a lot to me that she would have felt that our interactions were purposeful and offered something to her for her career and then to pour into others. That means a lot to me. I think I was just kind of sharing with her over time what things had been done in my case that had been helpful and some that had been hurtful, and hoping to use those as, you know, opportunities for growth and to close some of those gaps for future victims.
One of the other things that she told me a story about is that she was outside of the courtroom with you and your family was there and they were a little bit away from you. And you turned to her and said, "It's not their job," referring to your family, "to support me in the courtroom. It's your job." And she found that to be very powerful. And I was wondering what you meant by that and how we can make that distinction between a family's role in helping a victim versus the victim advocate's role.
One of the difficulties in overcoming, you know, a victimization is that the ripple effects that it has on your friends and family and coworkers and faith family, neighborhood, all of those things. And often they try to step in and help, but not really knowing what to say. We've all been in that position where something's happened and we haven't quite known the words to say to support someone. And in this particular case, I found my family, I almost felt them sharing their emotions and their fears and worries kind of on me, as if we were, you know, working through it kind of together. And in the moments of the courtroom, particularly when I was being called as a witness to testify, you know, the stress of that and the anxiety is so big that it's really almost necessary to just really do that individually, to step outside of those relationships or family, people that are there to support you, but then to lean into, for example, the advocate, where she's just my person and she or he would be just the victim's person. And that really seemed to make a difference. And I hope that was taken in a constructive way, or just I was leaning in for help because I remember my family's emotions really taxing me as well, particularly my father's in his grief as he heard things come out on the stand. And it was just really difficult for him to manage. And he was collapsing in my arms. And I was trying to say, I can't, I don't know what to do. So.
What? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that was it. Sorry.
No, that's okay. So I want to go to 1992 or thereabouts. And this is would be after all four defendants have been sentenced. And at that time, I'm curious what your belief was as to when these individuals would be released. And we'll talk about more recent events later. But at that moment, what was your belief as to whether or not these individuals would be spending the rest of their life in prison?
Well, because of the amount of assaults, the number of rapes, the numbers of sodomy, and just the kind of the physical force and violence of it, I assumed that they probably would be, you know, charged in ways that would keep them in prison most of their adult life. And I kind of felt as if maybe I can live the adult stages of my life out and try to find some peace and try to be healed, but that I wouldn't maybe have to address them being back in the communities where I lived and worked and things like that. But unfortunately, I found that not to be true. It seems like the sentences, while long and unlayered, it doesn't seem to, you know, hold as much weight in the Department of Corrections, maybe their systems, as I thought it would.
You know, as to the legal case itself, I got the impression that sentencing wasn't the end, if you will, but rather almost just one milestone along a timeline that would stretch out for many years. And one of the ways, if you've told me about that, the case continues to reemerge is this idea of a parole hearing. And I'm wondering, the first time this came up, and I don't need to remember obviously the exact year, but rather just the experience, how is it you're contacted to let you know that even though someone may have a sentence that appears to go off into infinity, that they are now up for a parole hearing? How does that come, as a phone call, as a letter, as an email? Could you tell us about that conversation?
Sure. Usually, well, there is a system, a national system, and then we also have it here in Missouri called Vine, and you can go on and put your information into a system attached to that particular offender that then notifies you of any changes in custody or of any upcoming things that are happening, like an example, a parole hearing. So it comes in the form of a phone call. And the interesting thing is that it's an automatic call. So you can choose two numbers for it to go to. So it's always gone to my parents' home and then also to my own number. And, you know, it just comes in at the most unlikely times. You get a recorded message saying, you know, this is the Department of Corrections calling regarding, and it'll say the offender's name. And it asks, you know, a few questions to identify if you're the correct receiver of the call. Then it delivers the message, whether it's a parole hearing scheduled for a date or maybe a move in custody or something. And then it has you punch in a PIN to say that, yes, you have received this information and they can stop calling. I received one of those first calls within 5 years. And I remember being so shocked as they had these long sentences, and I didn't understand how they would already be in the system for a parole hearing. I learned that that's part of the system to get them kind of in the system for the hearings so that they can kind of review what their status is, if they've had any negative moments in prison where they've been reprimanded for or anything like that, to kind of ask what classes or training they've gone through, things like that. But getting those calls, and I think I've received probably 10 or 11 now through the, you know, the last 30 years, is always a really shocking kind of life stopping moment. And particularly because it also goes to my parents' home, and through the years, you know, they've had to also be jolted by that call. And it's difficult.
You know, the idea of receiving a robocall, and I realize there's a number of probably calls that have to be made by the system, but still, the idea of receiving a what I'll call robocall in a situation that would have to trigger just an unbelievable avalanche of emotions seems to be almost unfair. Does that make sense in terms of the impact of it? And maybe there's not a better way. I don't know, but I'm curious as to what you think about that, having now received so many of these robocalls. I would hope almost that there'd be some individual calling up and say, Kim, we have a relationship already, whatever that position would be. And Kim, I want to tell you about so-and-so's up for parole. Let's talk about how you're feeling right now.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think the most efficient way is unfortunately through those robocalls. It does list and remind you of the victim services office number through the Department of Corrections. I stay in touch with them pretty regularly. So often they would reach out or they would contact me around that time and say, hey, you know, I'm sure you're aware there's a hearing coming up. What can I do to support you? How can we help? Do you have any questions? Those kind of things.
And what is it like then going to the parole hearing? You're given eventually a date and a time. And let's talk about one where the offender is physically present in the room. Mm-hmm. Tell us briefly about that. You're actually, first of all, you're going into an actual prison. You have to go through a security, a metal detector. There are certain rules that you have to follow. Could you walk us through that experience?
Sure. The first hearing that I attended was within those first, you know, by 5 to 8 years. And it was in a small room in a prison down south of St. Louis. And I remember my parents were going to go along with me as well as a former advocate. You can only have one person in a room as a representative or as a support person with you. And I remember I chose to ride the train there from, you know, where I live, because I wanted just that time to let this sink in. And they also allow you to make a statement to the parole board if you so choose. So I wanted time to kind of think through what I might even say. But for that particular hearing, I was in the same room with the offender. And it was very difficult being that close in proximity to him, seeing his face as he talked, that sort of thing. I only attended one other hearing like that. But in our state, they were all incarcerated at different institutions. So the hearings have been at different places. the next several that I attended, I wanted to be in person because I did feel like it was a right. It is a victim's right in our state to attend. And you can attend, you can write a letter, you can attend via video conferencing. There are several options. You can write a letter. But by being there, I wanted to show basically that this had not taken me out, you know, that this hadn't necessarily defined my life in a way that took my strength. It defined my life in what I had to deal with, but I chose to be there so that they were forced to hear my voice and hear the words that I said to the hearing, to the parole board. It also gave me a chance to hear their words. And I think I've always been seeking some sort of remorse. And, you know, unfortunately, in all of the hearings I've attended, I haven't heard much of that from them. But it allowed me to hear firsthand what they've been doing in prison, if they've attended any classes, bettered themselves, if they had a faith life in prison. So it made me feel a little bit more connected to the post-conviction part of the process.
So since then, you've been to how many parole board hearings? You said maybe 12 at least or more?
Well, I think I've been to 8. Oh, yeah. A couple have been canceled, or the defendant requested not to have them because of either conduct in prison at the time, or just simply because they weren't ready to face me, basically. And so they declined the hearing.
Looking at some of the other processes you went through or other places of strength you look to, I know spiritual is one of them. And part of your story that I learned about is that you were baptized a few weeks before this incident occurred in 1990. And what I found shocking to me, at least, and is understanding when the event happened. I guess me being more of a pessimist, I would think, oh my goodness, I've accepted this belief and I wasn't protected. But you rather, you took a more positive view to it, actually, that you were looked after and you were protected. Could you explain that to us?
Yeah, you know, thank you for asking about that. It's really an important piece because you're right. I didn't have a lot of knowledge about that relationship and what, you know, being a Christian and being baptized really meant. But what I did understand is that there were promises that I could hold on to, and it informed me in my mind and heart that this, while this was happening to me, this was kind of an act of man, and it was not maybe the plan for my life. There was something else, you know, that I was purposed to do and meant to do. And so I was just trying to seek that. I feel like during many hours of the assault, I was kind of held, you know, there was so much brutality, more than I think my spirit and body could take. And it was leaning into that was kind of a safe place, trusting that, you know, if I got out alive, that, you know, something, I could do something, it would be okay.
And so going further in that, the idea of, or the religion and your faith, the concept of forgiveness to you, what does that mean? We'll talk about it, what it meant at the time after the sentences and after, as you're continuing to go through the healing process, what the term forgiveness meant to you.
To me, forgiveness means releasing myself actually of the shame and any blame or any guilt that I might have had around, you know, the things that people try to put on you that you may have done to contribute to this or make this happen or be at fault. I knew none of those were true, but there's something inside of you that feels like, what could I have done differently? So forgiveness not only freed me, forgiveness allowed me to free them as well. And in understanding and trying to understand what had happened in their life or what they had been victim to before that would have enabled or allowed them to do these things and take these actions. And it pivoted, I think, and allowed me to release anger and hurt and step into that healing.
That's interesting because you're talking about part of that forgiveness, not only in how you view those four offenders, but also how you're viewing yourself. The concept of you having to forgive yourself for something horrific that someone else did sounds it's striking. And why is that? You're saying because there's certain ideas that are placed upon you that somehow you did something or somehow this terrible thing, somehow, as crazy as it sounds as we're talking about, was somehow your fault in some way.
Yes. I mean, the world tries to put so much blame, particularly on, you know, rape victims, as if something you wore or something you said or something you didn't say or something you did somehow contributed. And, you know, the facts are that I was wearing a long sleeve shirt or like a 3/4 and long shorts. There was nothing about my attire or anything that I engaged in with them to contribute to them. I was simply, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I needed to shed those myths and that blame from others to release the shame, because the shame is believing that something is wrong with you, something that you did or somehow who you are allowed this or caused this. And I had to work to know that that wasn't true.
We're talking with Kim Case about how she has survived a horrific assault 30 years ago, and how the healing process has taken her through those 30 years. When we come back, we'll learn more about that journey and more about what she has done to help other victims and survivors. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Support for KKFI comes from Union Station and Auschwitz, the exhibition. Not long ago, not far away. The exhibition at Union Station features over 700 original objects and over 400 historic images. This comprehensive exhibition is dedicated to the history of Auschwitz and its role in the Holocaust. Auschwitz, not long ago, not far away. The exhibition, now extended through March at Union Station. More information and reserved tickets are available now at unionstation.org.
Tune in every Monday from 3 to 6 p.m. for Mother's Mix, where your host, Lady D, will bring a great mix of music to your afternoon. That's Mother's Mix every Monday from 3 to 6 p.m. right here on KKFI.
Oh, yeah. I got my mojo working.
Hello, all. I want to update you on the Amp Up for the Future campaign. We have topped $113,000 so far in this investment in KKFI's future. That means we still have $81,000 in matching commitments from a group of wonderful KKFI supporters. Whether it's a one-time gift or a commitment over a couple years, please consider an extra gift above your normal generosity. Or, of course, make your first gift right now, and it will be matched dollar for dollar. To double your gift to KKFI right now, go to kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Again, that's kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Thanks for listening.
Now the calendar for the week of December 20th. The Kansas City chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants has a monthly virtual meeting. Missouri Cure advocates for the human rights of prisoners in Missouri prisons and jails, as well as for those who have returned to society. For information, please call Keith Brownell at 816-317-2873. Monday, December 20th, is Monday Meets at 3 p.m., an online event hosted by the Willow Domestic Violence Center on Facebook Live. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That list is updated daily. Thanks to all our listeners. Please stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found at the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Stan Thomas.
This is Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. Today we're talking with Kim Case, victim, survivor of a horrific sexual assault 30 years ago. When we left off, we were talking about the shame that many victims feel as if somehow they contributed in their own way to the assault. That sounded to me like it kind of imposed upon them by society. And what I want to talk to you now, Kim, is about another shame that I didn't even think about before we got to know each other. And that was the shame of not reporting. And you had indicated, you had told me about a story of someone that had approached you, and we're not need to use names unless you would want to, but someone who had approached you to talk about one of the offenders and what that offender may have done to her prior to the offense that involved you. I was wondering if you could share that with us, please.
I received a message through social media a few years back from a male indicating that his girlfriend had known the offenders and that she had been victim to one of them, possibly two of them, much earlier on and before my assault. And he was reaching out really in grief, asking if I would be willing to talk with her because she chose not to report after the assault on her. And it was a similar assault, a kidnapping and some brutal rapes. And she had known them before. And I think that she, for many reasons, didn't feel safe enough to report.
So you talked about the gentleman, someone contacted you on social media.
Yes, he contacted me asking if I would be willing to talk with her, that she, through the years, had held a lot of grief and a lot of guilt over not sharing with the police or making a report. And she felt like somehow it was her fault that this happened to me. And I heard from her that she had never shared it with anyone. She had so much guilt and so much brokenness around it. And her life had kind of been identified by that as well in the struggles that she faced. And we did eventually meet and get together. And there was a great release of emotion for us both, where I was able to say to her that I in no way held her responsible or blamed her, reminded her boldly that the actions taken by these offenders was their responsibility alone. And it was their blame, the blame was on them, and that she had nothing to feel bad about and didn't contribute to what had happened to me. And as a matter of fact, I tried to remind her that even if she had made a report, it's sometimes not handled effectively by those taking the report, and perhaps nothing would have changed and they still would have done the assault on me. So it did, however, show me the volatility and the violent nature of these offenders, and particularly the one that reached out and grabbed me. And it sort of changed the way that I had over the years felt towards them, as if hopefully they were working towards remorse and restoration and healing. And instead I saw in my mind's eye more of a monster, as if not only he had made this bad decision and perpetrated this crime on me and egged on his friends and family to do it with him, but that this was his course of being. This was maybe who he was. And honestly, it was a setback for me, fearing that, he still had that in him and that maybe I had given them too much grace and too much forgiveness. And I'm not sure I've really been able to stabilize that within me. It still just goes up and down.
So let's talk then about this individual in particular. When we first started out at the beginning of the show, it was the thought process was these individuals had received, and I've read the list of sentences, and you need a calculator to calculate all the sentences out, consecutive, concurrent. It's very confusing, but the numbers are very large. And then all of a sudden you receive notice of something somewhat recently. And if you could briefly talk to us about that.
Yes, so this particular offender, I've had two parole hearings on. Because he was had served time before, I really thought that he would be in there the longest. He was the one that perpetrated the incident and so forth. The first hearing was like in 15, and that's when his parole officer in the institution really let me know that it was a possibility that he could have a release date at some point in the next 10 years. So at that point, maybe that was 13 or 14, I say. And then about a year and a half ago, I went to a second parole hearing for him, not believing, though, that he would be granted a release date. I thought that this was just another step in the process of them checking in with him to see what programs he was engaged in, to kind of see if he had been any in any kind of situations or altercations. And so I went in feeling fairly strong that, you know, this was just another step in the process. And I received a letter and a call about a week later saying that he had been granted a release date and that he simply had to complete the Missouri Sexual Offender Program. And if he completed that successfully, that he would be released. And they had devised a release plan for him, possibly where he would live and work. And again, it was a big setback because it dawned on me that not only had it seemed the system was kind of failing me again by really not honoring the sentences that had been handed down by the judges and juries and those in the system, but because of technicalities, basically, and things that are still kind of beyond my understanding, was given this date. And they described the sexual offender program just briefly, that there would be some counseling and some things like that where he'd have to talk about the crimes he perpetrated. But I just wasn't sure if there was rehabilitation that had occurred. And with the knowledge of the other assaults that had occurred and perhaps others that I was unaware of, that truly it would be as if this person was released back into society, very likely to offend again. And it has been very difficult to manage. There are times when I just have to put it aside because it's more than I can bear. He would be working really in nearby cities and so forth and in the same state. And so I did reach out to the Victim Services Program and they allowed me to have contact with his institutional parole officer to kind of check to see what his status was. And I made that call. I didn't really get a lot of information, unfortunately. But then they also have allowed me, if I'm willing, to write a statement or write a letter to the board of the sexual offender program. And that's something I'm still just kind of crafting. I've never, David, gone into the hearings demanding that they be kept in longer. I've never asked for any certain thing other than sharing with them what the experiences have been to live with this and what it means every day, what my family has gone through, what I see when I look in the mirror. And I've let the professionals make those determinations. And so I've been a little bit scarred with some regret of maybe I should have been more bold in saying, hey, it's too early, you need to keep him. But I'm just not sure that that has been my role or my job. There's a lot of interesting ups and downs with this type of situation.
What I hear, Kim, is almost the same thing that the other person came to you with and said, my goodness, had I done this or something, I now feel responsible for Kim, what happened to you. And I hear in your voice, this taking on this additional burden of saying, maybe I should have pressed harder to keep them in longer, whatever it may be. And I guess, Kim, it almost seems unfair to me that you would have to bear that burden. And I don't know, I guess my first question about it is, did the parole board give a reason to you? Do they say, well, we've decided that after this period of time that he's satisfied these requirements, or is there anything, or is it just like, hey, we're giving him a date and he's going to go through this program?
Yeah, basically that was it. We're giving him a date and, you know, Unfortunately, because of my work in the criminal justice system and in helping victims, I learned about some things that were going on kind of at the state level with other sentences in Department of Corrections and them wanting, you know, the overcrowding issue, the justice reform issue, all of these different things that affect the decisions. And in fact, our state is being looked at under a microscope for, you know, keeping offenders longer maybe or not giving. There was an issue around juvenile life sentences and wanting to review those and give them dates. Juvenile life without parole, I think was what I should have said. So there were factors that I think influenced this that I don't think I have control over, which adds a burden of unfairness, like you said. And it's a kind of another, I don't want to just be coy and say another victimization, but it continues the battle that I go through in not being able to completely move away from the situation and, you know, the way that I have to just deal with this pain and uncertainty every day. And now here it's going to be again, and he'll be walking free.
And so what is it that you look to for strength? We've talked about the spiritual side. What about mental health? You know, you mentioned that the offender is going to go through MOSOP, the Missouri Sex Offender Program, but what about the mental health process for you to deal with the pain, to deal with the what I can imagine are just reoccurring nightmares potentially, so that you could live a fulfilling life for yourself with loving relationships with a partner, perhaps children, whatever it may be?
You know, that's one of the big barriers to moving forward from a crime like this, is because it's truly touched every bit of your body and your mind and your soul. The violations, it's internal even with the rapes. And so definitely had to seek good, healthy counseling and was a part of that for years, finding someone that really understood the dynamics of this type of victimization and helped me not only through the court process, but then, you know, for years after. My faith has been a very important piece of my healing, because sometimes it's so big, David, that I know that there's no way I can think my way through it or heal my way through it, that some of it just has to come and just has to be. And so that has been, I've just tried to accept that some of it is outside of me and I just have to allow it. And then doing things that were healthy, you know, like exercise and spending time with friends, safe places. But, you know, it touched every facet of my life, and it's a lot to overcome. And then add to it the difficulty of working through the criminal justice system and the maze that it is, and the ups and the downs and the ins and outs of the three counties and just not knowing what to expect, you know, added to the burden. So I'd say definitely the counseling. There's times I've had to be on antidepressants or anti-anxiety to kind of help with some of those nightmares, reoccurring thoughts and triggers. For years, there were so many triggers. And, you know, one of the biggest was the sound of a zipper. And, you know, you put clothes on every day and there's zipper. So that was something that I just had to push myself through. I would look in the mirror and not even see myself. Things like that just haunt you. So you work through those and you try to redefine those and reassign. One of the big triggers for me was hay, because it was a lot of the assaults were in a barn, and yet I loved horses and always dreamed of having horses. And so, you know, when I made it to that stage, I definitely had to overcome the fear of a barn and horses and all of the sounds and smells that were so triggering to me, being, you know, handcuffed and held in a barn for so many hours. You know, it's an ongoing process, honestly.
One of the most powerful images or that we talked about before this was how this is connected to a child, to physically to the child, that the very place where the physical assault, one of the places where the physical assault happened, was a place that a child had to pass through. And that was just that, you know, the image, it's unbelievably powerful. And I wonder if you could talk about that very briefly and how you move on from that, and you can never forget, but how you would possibly be able to move forward in some manner, the strength that it takes to do that.
Yeah, that is an area that I haven't spoken of a lot, not because I don't want to, but because it is so tied to the egregiousness of the assault, that then in the joy of creation and trying to celebrate life and bring life into the world of my precious infant, that it had to pass through that birth canal and the body that had been raped, and not just raped once, but more times than I could even count. And the you know, violent nature of the assaults, I had to really work with a counselor to allow myself to share the information with my doctors so that they could also be prepared for the experience. And, you know, fortunately, by making the choice to be transparent and to be honest about this embarrassing situation, you know, they provided a really comfortable and comforting atmosphere, you know, allowed me to choose a doctor, and even the on-call situation of, you know, one doctor not being available and so forth, they really worked with me to make it as comfortable as possible. And as a matter of fact, my first delivery ended up being C-section because of really a number of those situations where my body just wouldn't work. And I was able to, you know, have that type of birth next. And it was something that I had to work towards, kind of owning and taking back my body, basically, really taking back my body.
One of the things that I find one of the things that impresses me so much about you, Kim, is the strength that you show in your vulnerability and your willingness to share such intimate details. And I'm wondering, is that part of the healing process for you? Because when you lay it all out there and it is what it is, there's no debating it. That truly may be the strongest thing anybody can do. Here I am. This is me. And I'm wondering, is that intentional on your part to, as part of how you kind of, as you're talking about taking back who you are?
I think that there are several, you know, prongs to that answer, in that I realized quickly that there were so many gaps in the system that made it very difficult for victims to move through it successfully and feel empowered. So it became kind of a badge of honor to step into working in that field to try to close some of those gaps for other people. And I just thought, wow, if I can share with all of the stakeholders in the system what this is really like, maybe there would be change. But I could only really do it by just laying my heart out there for them, because, you know, people work in the system to do good and to be champions and for justice. And sometimes the unintended consequences of things caused harm. And so it's hard to say, well, that caused harm. I know they didn't mean to. And so just in constructive ways of small tweaks that made things better. And then at the same time, I think being a woman in overcoming something like this, I wanted to just stand strong, because there are so many people that have been victimized that don't have a voice. Either they didn't survive, they didn't make it out alive, they were killed, or that just by surroundings or by life experiences didn't have the strength or didn't have the support to have the words. And I believed that my faith was empowering, encouraging me to step out and be that voice. So by doing that, during those years, some things were happening nationally with victims' rights amendments happening at different states and things like that. So it began to feel somehow like, okay, I can understand that this has happened in my life, but if I can turn it and use it for some good, you know, maybe, again, not only that they won't have won, but maybe they can see somehow that, you know, there can be restoration and healing, and even for them and what they may have faced in childhood or what, you know, they didn't have access to in life to give them the right kind of mindset for choices, you know, maybe they could see that, that there's still hope. I think it all has just come down to hope for me, David. Yeah.
And part of the work that you've talked about doing, I think, resulted in part in the passage of the Missouri Crime Victims' Rights Amendment. And you were instrumental in that. And looking at it now, I mean, it's enshrined in the Constitution, the Missouri Constitution. That seems to have some power to it, some meaning to it. If you could talk to us just a little about that and about what that meant for you at the time and what that means for victims and survivors moving forward.
Sure. It was really an honor to be able to speak during those years about the situation because it was so unique in the that there were the three jurisdictions that were involved. And so, you know, kind of termed it the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I've never been one to accuse or to find necessarily fault. I tried to spin it in a way where things, in showing how things could be different and better. By being able to share, because there were so many amazing things, like the advocates that stepped alongside me and carried this burden in their own life and heart. And I knew that, and they were there for me. And the law enforcement officers that were there and that, you know, supported me and championed me and spoke hope into my heart about my ability to recover and all of those things. I wanted to honor them by that. And so by being, you know, by having that voice during those times, it did empower me to maybe want to make change that would affect someone else's life in the future. And I could find peace in, you know, turning this situation for some sort of good. It was never a calculated thing. I had never, you know, spoken to legislature before or been a part of those types of situations. I mean, I was 20 or 21, so young at the time, but it was a really clear example of what was working and wasn't working. And I felt like it was worth it to give that example in some way that maybe someone could really be moved and could understand and changes could be made.
You know, it seems that it almost started, we started in the beginning of the hour of the discussion as you as evidence, as a physical thing. And it the impression I get, at least as indicated by this amendment, that all of a sudden turns into you as a person are now a stakeholder in this process. And that affirmation of your humanity and the humanity of victims and survivors seems just so, so important. And I wonder if you found that to be true in terms of the impact of your work in this area on others who share similar experiences with you.
David, I think so. That was really beautifully said. It definitely does change my perspective on the ability to see good fruit from this. And at the end of the day, I think that's all we can really ask is that we each as human beings pull up our bootstraps, we lean on each other, and we move forward in love and in goodness. And while this was so dirty and such a horrific event, my personality and how I was made was to bring good back into the world if possible.
Kim, I am in awe of you and of your strength. And you are an inspiration. And I just wanted to thank you so much for taking a few moments to be here and to share your experiences with us.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate having a chance to have a voice to share. And some may wonder, you know, why would I want to speak about these negative things? And there's days I ask myself that too, but I just hope that one person can hear it and understand that there is hope, that there is the next. And I believe there's so much possibility in the next. And I just want to give that to people.
Thank you so much, Kim. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
nearing my prime. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, send email inquiries and comments to kkfi.org/contact. This is Terry, reminding you that our outro music is Better Man from the Plane for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9, followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Link's Mix with Mixmaster Link, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en...
Gen Z.
Hello, all. I want to update you on the Amp Up for the Future campaign. We have topped 113,000 so far in this investment in KKFI's future. That means we still have 81,000 in matching commitments from a group of wonderful commitment in KKFI's future. That means we still have 81,000 in matching commitments from a group of wonderful KKFI supporters. Whether it's a one-time gift or a commitment over a couple years, please consider an extra gift above your normal generosity. Or, of course, make your